Thank you, John. I think some great perspectives there across those three spectrums, and your observations around academia and the current focus on the quantitative side or the science of risk management and the potential need to enhance it with some of the softer skills and elements is quite an interesting observation to make at the actuarial conference. But I think it's an observation that does ring true. Before I introduce our last speaker, Dennis Fox, can I please remind people to SMS their questions through, and the number once again is 0417 125 300. Shifting to the last speaker on our panel, Dennis Fox, again, a very well-regarded director, serving on the boards of some of the world's largest entities, Swiss Re, director here in Swiss Re Life and Health Australia, a member of the advisory board of Swiss Re Reinsurance Limited, and a member of the advisory board of Swiss Re International. So I think probably some great perspectives around the global implications for risk and what we're seeing. But also closer to home, a director on OnePath Life Limited, and also on the audit and REM committees of OnePath. So prior to that, also on the board of IAG NRMA Super, and the chair of their investment committee. So if I can just invite Dennis up, he'll be our last speaker before we get into the questions.
Thanks very much for that kind introduction. I find this somewhat odd that I'm standing up here now talking to an Institute of Actuaries conference or seminar. It's been a bloody long time since I've been in an actuarial gathering. I think about 30 years ago I sort of tried to make it my realm, except for sort of little intermittent jumps back in and out of the profession, to do as little of it as I could. Even when I was on a point in action for a life company, I managed to make sure I could hire people that knew what they were doing. So, you know, you can actually get a long way in some ways, but it's interesting how all that occurs, because I think it's a part of risk management. And this was personal risk management. So now on enterprise risk management. I should go back into the personal risk management faction for them. I really wanted to sort of... I had a very strong drive to make a lot of money and all that, and I didn't always achieve that outcome, but certainly I found that if I was going to be an actuary and really good at it, I probably wouldn't have thought I would do as well as I would have done. So I figured that was my risk management, was to make profits for myself. And I think enterprise risk management is about risk management for an enterprise to make profits. That's why you have risk management. No other reason. If you think your business is in business to make a loss, then you're mad. Unfortunately, I just wish all the time we made profits. But just to give that some context, and I just use my career, from 1991 to 2008, when I left, I guess, the corporate world and joined this hirsute world of directors and getting older and all and losing, changing the hair colour. I changed my hair colour actually as an executive, but certainly as a director that doesn't get changed back. In 1991, I had the joy of becoming the appointed actuary for Tyndall Life. For those of you who may not know who Tyndall Life, it doesn't exist today. There's another former appointed actuary over there, shaking his head, not this story. But anyway, Tyndall Life had a market capitalisation of $10 million when I joined. Our capacity to manage risk was really so good that every month we had to get the premium run in and make sure we could pay salaries, let alone claims. And through focus, hard work, understanding the market and taking risks, and preserving our capital base. In 1999, Royal and Sun Alliance paid our shareholders $755 million for the business. That was a reasonable return if you had to have invested in Tyndall that time. From 1999 to 2003, I was with Royal and Sun Alliance, not always happy times, but I found working for a UK parent a fascinating business, but I'll leave that. In 2003, the Australian and New Zealand operations of Royal and Sun Alliance paid RSA PLC $1.85 billion for the business and listed as a company called Promina. Now, if you don't know where, Promina had a rather historic run. And just over 3 years later, were bought by Suncor for $7.6 billion. I stayed at Suncor after that, which was probably another one of those decisions I probably should have rethought. But I left in 2008. So I really wanted to comment. The reason I want to use that as an example is that if you actually understand your business and focus on it, you can make a substantial difference. And that is what risk management is about. Who gives a shit about heat maps? Right? That's going to be an academic or an actuary trying to give us something to read. I agree with Trevor and John to an extent about the problem we currently have with a lot of the risk management information is that it's verbose and meaningless and doesn't focus in on what the board needs to know. So as a director of any of these companies, my role is to ensure that they have long-term profitability and the enterprise survives. And to expect that's going to occur, the board has to ensure that management have a clear understanding of the level of risk the board is prepared to accept in management achieving the board's objectives. It is not about management telling us what level of risk they want to accept. Because the only thing we know at the start of the year is the amount of capital we have. We therefore have to make sure we can ascribe that capital, and the process is horrible, and the process could be improved one day. But the point is, that is our decision. So we need to take risk. The only reason we're in business is to take risk. Every time we take risk, we have the chance to make profits. We just need to manage the risks we take and understand them. And, APRA some time ago and many other people have come up with the concept of fit and proper. I always think it's fascinating to understand what fit and proper means. Because originally it sort of meant about having policies and procedures in place to assess that responsible persons were competent to do their job, able to do their job, and resourced to do their job. And I thought that was pretty sensible. When I became a board member, I realised that didn't mean that at all. Fit meant you had to be strong enough to carry your bloody board papers. Because if you had RASs, an HCR, ILVR, and a peer review report, you bloody well couldn't carry them in one bag. And then people thought, oh, well, now we'll use iPads. Fitness now means I have to have perfect bloody vision. I've never had perfect vision. So how do you actually come, without any of the academia stuff and without being an actuary, to understand what risk appetite is and how it works? Well, one of the advantages by being a director of Swiss Re is that we had a chance in New York to have a case study. So I'm going to just pick up some issues from the case study. And I'm going to start, firstly, there's an AMIC report called The Road to Ruin. It's a very interesting report if you want to get it in full. And now this is not new. Right? This is not something that all of a sudden occurred in 2010. This is about 2001, I think. They investigated 18 high-profile corporate crises of the last decade. Companies involved in these crises included AIG, they've been involved again, Arthur Andersen, doesn't exist, BP, we'll go into them later, Cadbury Schweppes, Coca-Cola, EADS Airbus, Enron, Firestone, McLaren, Northern Rock, Shell and Societe Generale. The aggregate pre-crisis value of these businesses was in excess of $6 trillion. In seven cases, the company faced bankruptcy, of which three were rescued by governments. 11 cases, the chairman and or CEO lost their jobs. And in all cases, senior executives and NEDs had their reputation severely tarnished. And the company paid heavy fines. And as part of that, we then did a reasonably in-depth look at BP. And I will give a plug for the consulting firm that did it. Reputability. They're from the Case Business School in the UK. They did. It was a really fascinating case study. And if anybody could ever understand what does risk mean, just think about BP. The case study is called The Road to Deepwater Horizon. I assume most people in the room know what Deepwater Horizon is, but we'll get there if you don't. So BP is a conglomerate of some really large state-owned, formerly state-owned oil enterprises, and had a history for a long period of time of severe accidents. So before Deepwater Horizon, there were four events in BP's history. In March 2005, the Texas City refinery exploded. 15 people were killed, hundreds were injured, cost BP $1.6 billion. In 2006, the Alaskan oil pipeline leaked. In one leak alone, they lost 200,000 gallons. And they had to replace 22 miles of corroded pipeline. And then, in October 2009, the Occupational Safe and Healthy Organisation in the US actually levied their largest fine ever of $87 million to BP. Now, you should assume that after every one of those events, preeminent persons were asked to review the BP business and recommend changes to the business model and how they should proceed to implement those changes. And that certainly occurred. But in April, on the 26th of April 2010, there was a Deepwater Horizon explosion. 11 workers were killed. There was a massive oil. No one really knows the level of oil that's leaked into the Gulf of Mexico. There was a $20 billion compensation fund set up by BP. They've paid so far $7.8 billion in damages, apart from their compensation fund, and they're still paying. They haven't actually settled the cases for the residents, the people who own land or live on islands within the Gulf of Mexico. And their share price was about £650 at the time of the event and has only now recovered to be about £450. So what do we learn from this, and how can we actually use it in our own businesses? And what do I as a director want to look at? Yes, I read the RAS. And I even read the bloody FCR. I don't know why I read FCRs at times. And as for reading peer review reports and ILVRs, why can't we make them? I mean, Trevor suggested a 4-page report. Please, any appointed actuaries in the room, try and make it 4 pages. I don't see why it's got to be 300. And if the Institute could only revisit its standards to actually reduce the need to put rubbish in them, it would even be better. But anyway, that's probably my last shot on that one, perhaps. The thing that I look for, and I know other directors, and the best thing about a board of directors is you don't want everybody to be the same. Yes, there are a lot of white males that are over 50. I'll say I'm 50. I'm over 50 anyway, that's true. And there could be lots of other people as well, because people from different backgrounds and different views bring different perspectives. So why do we want all these different perspectives? Because we want to see management. We want management to present what they believe they're going to do and how they're going to do it. And I want to get an in-depth understanding of their culture. I don't need surveys. I don't need reports from copious bloody consultants. Which you will get, by the way, if you work for a large company, you're bound to get a few of those. But what I do need to understand is, what is this culture of this organisation? You know, some simple things. Are people free to comment to the board in a board meeting that something went wrong? Are people free to be able to explain what they're doing about it? And are they free enough in the sense that they're not scared of their manager, or they're not scared by some peer or superior person that they think is going to go crook at them? It's a really subtle issue, far more important than most of the other issues you'll ever look at. It's like leading a business. For those of you who ever want to lead a business, what is the role of a business leader? Right? One thing is not as the fountain of all knowledge. Because I can assure you, every time I look back and I realise that there are so many people so much smarter than I am, and I could actually hire them for a lot less than I would want to pay myself to do that role. I never wanted to do that role. And that, as soon as I found that, boom, that's easy. That's a really simple thing to do. Because I could actually focus on trying to understand the environment the business was in, how I could actually grow that business, because I'm there to grow a business and survive, and make it survive. I want to do that. And I want to do that really well. And if I can motivate and engage my people to do that, then I think that's the sign of a good leader. But you need to have a lot of tools to do that. You need a lot of help to do that. We won't go through that now. I don't think it's part of enterprise risk management. So from my perspective, enterprise risk management is about helping the business develop itself. The easiest business in the world to run is a business that's dying. Every actuary knows how to do that, because all the numbers probably mean something. The hardest business is a business that wants to grow, because most of the numbers that are predicted for the future mean very little. They are just a best guess of what the outcome of some really exciting propositions may well be. I want to make sure those numbers that are predicted for the future are completely blown apart by the future, because I want to ensure that we actually have, we expose ourselves to the potential to be successful. Luck is not about, I believe luck is simply the capacity to position the business and or yourself to use your skills to achieve an outcome that no one else can believe in. That's luck. It's not gambling in the casino and winning. It's about ensuring that you can place your business and its products and services in the right spot at the right time, and you can make a lot of money. So from my point of view, enterprise risk management is really important. And yes, I will read the risk appetite statement, even if I tell certain few people in ACRA that sometimes it's a nonsense. But we won't go there. You can always say that to Ian, because he's quite easy. He used to work for me too. You see, that's the other problem you get this old. So I find the risk report, if used well, really helpful, because it enables people to think of what the boundaries are and when we want to extend those boundaries to really make it work. Because some products are really successful, most aren't. You want to belt the shit out of the really good one and close the really bad one. That's the Fox method of management. Thank you.